She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hi, welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and the Independent Archaeologists Guild. You're never too post-scarcity to steal cool stuff. I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn, a writer and a fan of the Spirit of the Century role-playing game.
And I'm Miles Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer and a fan of the Doctor Who Expanded Universe companion that hard drink and archaeologists in the future, Professor Bernice Summerfield.
Each episode, we watch stories from three different Star Trek shows and rank them on a big list of best to worst. We both love Star Trek, but as it's far from our first fandom, that makes us the ultimate objective voices on such a task. In this episode, we're kind of doing a Discovery synergy theme, similar to how we did this with Picard, where the trailer gave us a lot of things to be potentially wrong about, as far as this is what a Picard season three will be. We have even vaguer hints as to what Star Trek Discovery season five is going to be, despite having seen the trailer a couple of times. So each of these episode picks are vaguely themed around that. But before we go on, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Well, Charlie, I'm sure since we haven't discussed this beforehand, you'll be utterly surprised at my pick. It was, in fact, Dune Part 2.
David Lynch did a second one?
Yes, he did.
Oh, my God!
I had to take a crap ton of spice to warp my brain, like Bioshock Infinity style, into an alternate universe where David Lynch did a Dune sequel, and we never got Twin Peaks.
Oh, God. That's a... yeah, that's a tricky choice to make. I think I'd still want to stick with the Twin Peaks universe.
Yeah. I would say, like, you know, when you talk about a lot of creative failures and mishaps, it's sometimes we forget that we tend to look at stuff in individual vacuums. Mm. And not just as a series of consequences. Like, if Dune hadn't flopped, David Lynch probably wouldn't have written Blue Velvet, which then wouldn't have given us Twin Peaks, and then just like the last 30 years of Western television would probably not turn out the same way.
There'd definitely not have been a Riverdale.
No.
Yeah, I guess it is interesting when you see that sort of thing. Like with Dave Cockrum leaving the Legion of Superheroes was sad for that, but led to his artwork in Giant Size X-Men and some very iconic characters and looks. And of course, if Chris Claremont hadn't left X-Men, we wouldn't have had Sovereign Seven, that legendary classic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if Grant Morrison had never left New X-Men in the early Y2K, then we never would have had the Filth.
Filth's all right. So, anyway, in this universe, Dune Part 2 by Denis Villeneuve.
Yes.
Yeah, this was also what I've listed down on my pick of the fortnight.
My God, it's almost as if we have our own internal synergy at times.
Almost, and almost like we both wanted an excuse to talk about Dune briefly.
It's almost as if we actually talk to each other about stuff that's not Star Trek when we're not recording the show.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is just me making X-Men noises, really.
You do make a lot of X-Men noises. Schnicked.
Bamf.
Kaflow. What is Cypher's sound effect? Translate? Babelfish?
I mean, these days it's mainly just staring judgmentally and knowingly.
Is it like a sound effect associated with Cypher, a gunshot to the back?
Oh, poor Cypher. So yeah, Dune 2. Personally, I liked the first Dune. It was nicely designed, if sometimes shot a little, I don't know, a little straightforwardly, a little formally. And the same with this one, you know, it's basically, it's more of the same. If you liked the first Dune by Villeneuve, you'll enjoy this one. And this feels like a lot of the plot that the first one was promising, even if it's, you know, less of the cast that the first one had. It was an interesting experience, especially in the Crawley IMAX, which it's the only reason to go to Crawley. And yeah, it was nice and big, which was great for the landscapes, and for the extreme close-ups, a little less great, because there was a lot of extreme close-up action.
Yeah, I was in like the second row of the cinema, so I was literally kind of having to lean back and every so often just turn my head to the left to see what was going on over there, and then turn back to center frame. Like, yeah, Dune was my favorite novel at like 16.
Yeah,
it's not my favorite novel at 14. I personally feel that Dune shouldn't be anyone's favorite novel at 40.
Mm.
Just because I don't know. It feels like a book a 15-year-old would read and go, "This is real literature," and then go on to discover real literature in like your 20s. Like it's big, it's dense. I admit I was pleased that the film didn't pull punches with a lot of the Paul becomes a white savior narrative.
Yeah, it did a very nice job of purposefully undermining a lot of that, going, actually, people were here earlier and put the work in, and kind of are manufacturing this. You know, the sense that this is a lot of bullshit, is he going to believe his own hype? Is he up for becoming this messianic cult leader kind of figure? And yeah, it was interesting seeing them dial that up. I think partly to give Zendaya more to do, as Charney kind of, like, she's there, but as things go on, she kind of isn't as much.
Charney is there in the books, but she's basically, you've heard of the sexy lamp idea, that if you can take a character and if you can just basically replace them with a sexy looking lamp and nothing changes the plot, then you're a bad writer. And then Charney's just sort of there to kind of give Paul, just have Paul have a love interest, and to just kind of stay off to the side pouting because Paul decides to marry the emperor's daughter.
Yeah.
And like, I visually loved it. Mm. Some of the story beats I really liked. I liked the fact that they unabashedly say Paul's a bad guy here, and Paul basically becomes the villain of the story by the end. I love Christopher Walken as the Emperor and not apparently giving any fucks to how he thinks he sounds. So no attempt to have Christopher Walken speak the King's English and just doing his Christopher Walken bit.
Yeah.
There's more deep, this Paul Atreides, I think he needs more cowbell. love that. I feel the film, this is the same problem I had with the first one. It feels like it consciously takes itself too seriously.
Mm.
For a book with giant worms and sand, which is basically space drugs, does. And it feels like this is a conscious attempt to separate from the Dune film, because they consciously avoid saying the line, "Walk without rhythm and you won't attract the worm," which is a line from the book, which then got put in the film, and then got put in the Fatboy Slim song, Weapon of Choice, which also stars Christopher Walken in the music video. And it doesn't help that I saw the 84 Dune film a few weeks back.
Yeah.
And I kind of miss some of that larger-than-life space opera epic bombast, Whereas this was very much that kind of Game of Thrones, we're going to say everything very low and whispered and auspicious, and that's how the audience knows that this is serious adult drama.
I mean, an amount of that feels very much having Timothée Chalamet, who I wouldn't be confident he could do science fiction bombast as well, you know? And that kind of, yeah, slightly intense kind of quiet and down thing seems to be his equivalent almost. But yeah, I definitely feel there is a bit of that trying to Game of Thrones it, but sometimes when you see things, like I did give a bit of a laugh with the way that some of the people in their armored suits fly. And it's like, oh, good. Give me some weird science fiction bullshit like this. Like the harvesters and the varied kind of bits of technology and vehicles. Yeah, more of this, please.
Yeah, more of the strangeness, because Dune's a strange book. And I think it's one of those things where everyone kind of it's one of those texts that gets bumped up to be something a lot more serious and epic than sometimes the book itself actually is. Because, you know, even though we live in a time where the geek has won, and science fiction's, you know, a very huge literature, we're all still kind of subconsciously self-aware of the fact that we love science fiction, and it is about spaceships and robots, and even though there are, you know, you play on deeper themes, you can do anything, there is always that part of you that's kind of just self-conscious going, it's a little bit silly, isn't it, though?
Yeah, we need to either comment on how silly this is or just try and be extremely po-faced about it, being I guess, the MCU and the DCEU approaches, respectively. I'm curious to see what the next installment will bring, because I came into it not knowing whether there would or wouldn't be one. And when they had an extremely small cameo from Anya Taylor-Joy, I was like, okay, I think I know that this is going to be, they're going to be messiahing it. And I can only hope that one day we will get God Emperor of Dune. And God. Then you can't avoid the wacky bullshit.
No, you can't avoid the strangeness. I admit the fact that they kept Alia as just the freaky psychic embryo and never had, like, the fast growing intelligent child. That was part of which there was a part where it's like, Villeneuve, you fucking coward.
I don't know. I found that quite good as, like, this, you know, this creepy thing inside you telling you all these things rather
That's
than
not to say I didn't
like the baby
like
tech
it.
Would
like,
be
the,
a bit
like,
uncanny.
The bit when Jessica drinks the water of life, and the dying words of, like, the Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother is like, oh shit, abomination, dead. I'm like, okay, this is good.
Yeah,
but I again, it's just, I can't help but think, yeah, you know, Lynch gave us the 3-year-old with glowing blue eyes and killing the Baron. You know, it's like sometimes, like, we all kind of make fun of Sting in the black leather thong going, I will kill him, but sometimes you kind of want that, and is that a crime?
No, definitely not. Although I liked this Fade Rafa in different ways. Like, he was great fun. The Harkonnen world was great fun.
The bit when it all goes monochrome for the gladiator fight, I really liked.
The Harkonnens, like, as a whole, gave me very Mobius vibes. You know, their armor felt close to the Hunchback armor from the Incal. That kind of thing, you know.
Mobius did do a bunch of designs for the Yodorovsky.
That's
like, there's your kind of Mobius Dune connection there. But, like, obviously, I don't think that was they were taking old designs, but, you know, like you said, there is that Mobius influence. I kind of sometimes feel sorry for Dave Bautista, because he's at times he's really trying to show that he has, like, proper character actor vibes. Like his one scene in Blade Runner 2049, where he plays the replicant medic is like a nice little scene. He's great in Glass Onion.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, I kind of wanted more from you here, because you get supplanted as like the big bad of Arrakis really quickly. Again, you know, he's always great when he's on screen.
Yes. Like
he's definitely, he can do physicality really well.
So yeah, it's all in all, I'd say, yeah, it was a fun experience. I'm curious to see what happens when I rewatch Lynch's Dune, which Emma has said that out of the Lynch marathon, kind of the retrospective of watching his older works, that one she's up for joining me with. So we'll have to do that soon.
No Elephant Man.
I'll be doing Elephant Man. I don't think Emma cares for it. I don't know.
Okay.
We'll see.
What about Blue Velvet?
Hmm.
Yeah. There have been times where it's just like, you know, it's really hard to gauge my wife's my wife started really kind of getting into horror movies in the last few years. And it's just been like, okay, Eraserhead I can show, like going over my DVD collection, it's like this one, Eraserhead, yep. Blue Velvet, yep. No, sorry, and then Elephant Man. Yup. Reach Blue Velvet. Not that one. Okay. Lost Highway? Possibly.
Hmm. Anyway, this is not a Dune cast. We are here to talk about Star Trek and about things which might vaguely relate to either thematically or, well, actually, no, pretty much only thematically. Discovery Season 5, based only on two viewings of the trailer. So, our first episode is from Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 3, Episode 19, titled Captain's Holiday, picked for archaeological kind of things, treasure hunt type things, and so on, because it looks like that's going to be a big element in Discovery Season 5. It aired on the 2nd of April, 1990. It's written by Ira Stephen Baer, normally known for DS9, and directed by Chip Chalmers, which sounds like a pseudonym.
Sounds like a Stan Lee superhero secret identity.
Definitely. The UK number one hit was Snap with The Power, and the US had Joan Jett and Blackhearts with I Love Rock and Roll. These were both entertaining. I don't know if I've ever heard The Power in full.
No, I think it's always been something I've heard in like commercials or as sort of like a needle drop gag in a TV show.
Definitely. Yeah. And Joan Jett, I've heard less of Joan Jett than I should have. But yeah, I always enjoy her work.
Especially as an X-Men fan.
I know. And
given that she's the visual model for Lila Cheney.
Yes. Yeah. But watching a video, it's like, oh yeah. Yeah, here we are.
For some reason, I always thought that this song was like an Aerosmith song. I don't know why, it just has that kind of hair metal.
Hmm.
But yeah, like out of the music we had to make ourselves listen to for this episode of the podcast, this was the stuff I liked.
Definitely. All right, so Mars, I believe you're recapping.
I am.
Captain's Holiday. Let's see how well you do with that. So, yeah, time to don your sexy riser outfit and go digging for some treasure. And begin.
The Enterprise is heading for Starbase 27 for a refit, and after 2 weeks negotiating a treaty, Captain Picard is exhausted. Oh ho, says Riker. I think our captain needs a holiday. I'm good, says Picard, who hates holidays. Oh ho, says Troy. I think my mother's visiting. Oh look, is that the time, says Picard. I think I need a holiday. Oh ho, says Riker. I hear Riser's very nice this time of year. I've already booked you a room, Captain. Can you do me two favors? One, can you pick me up a statue called a Horgon? And two, and this is the most important one, don't do any research to the into the place and customs of the planet you're going on holiday. Nothing suspicious here, says Picard, and promptly beams down to Riser, and gets immediately snogged by the strange woman called Vash. This is all watched by two aliens who've been waiting for Captain Picard to arrive for the last few days. Picard unpacks his books, gets Riker's statue, and immediately gets propositioned by five women who clearly want to ride Picard's sexy bald head, while he just wants to read. Turns out that statue Riker wanted him to pick up is actually a 24th century equivalent of Tinder, and Picard has been swiped right a lot of times, and Picard just wants to swipe left. Oh, Riker, you scamp, Picard thinks as he returns to his book. Suddenly, he gets approached by a Ferengi called Sovak. Oh no, does he want to ride Picard's sexy bald head as well? Thankfully for both 90s heteronormativity and broadcast standards in practice, he's here because he wants something off Vash. Apparently, the two of them are working together on something, and she has this disc that he really wants. Picard is done. He's going back to his room and runs into Vash. Suddenly, Sovak pops up and demands the disc. Vash claims ignorance and quickly slips the disc into the hand towel that Picard is wearing as some kind of sexy robe. Back in his room again, Picard gets accosted by the two aliens from earlier. Do they want to ride Picard's sexy bald head as well? No, they're actually Vorgans from the 27th century. They're looking for a device called a Toxutot, a powerful device built in the 27th century and is hidden back in the past that Picard is destined to find. Picard has heard the legend, but has no clue about any of this, but he finds the disc that's been hidden in his G-string. Confronting Vash, she tells him that she worked with Professor Estrigan. Professors Vladimir and Godot clearly weren't involved in the Enterprise to try and find the Toxutot, and Sovak also helped, but now she's tracked it to Riser, and there's no way she can get to it without Sovak finding out and trying to steal it off her. Picard agrees to help, but before they can leave, Sovak turns up with a gun! Turns out that Vash was contracted by Sovak to steal the disc, and instead stole his money and the disc to get to Riser, and he wants both the disc and her. Hey Sovak, not about a Hogar, Picard punches out Sovak, and he and Vash grab some tools and rush to where the Toxutot is supposed to be buried. Picard is kind of weary of all this, but he has to admit he's actually starting to have fun instead of the book reading. They kiss and get to work digging up the Toxutot, both the Vorgans and Sovak turning up to watch. But there's nothing to be dug up. Picard concludes that the professor's data was wrong and there's nothing here. The Vorgans disappear and Sovak grabs a shovel and starts digging himself, looking for the treasure of the Sierra Madre. Back in his room, Picard is contacted by Riker, who tells him that they're in orbit and can beam him up. Picard tells him, hey, not yet, and tells Riker to prepare a transporter code 14. Turns out that Vash tried to use Picard to do a little double cross. She had actually found and pocketed a Toxutot earlier, and was just using Picard and everything to get Sovak off her back and plan to Scarpa without telling Picard. The Vorgans turn up, demanding the relic, and Vash tells Picard that the professor's notes mentions two Vorgans turning up to try and steal it. Picard asks if this is true, and the Vorgans pull out a gun. Picard grabs the Toxutot and tells Riker to initiate transporter code 14, and the Toxutot explodes. The Vorgans tell Picard that he was destined to destroy it as well as discover it, and now that's done, they can go home. Vash offers to come with Picard to be ship's archaeologist, but Picard knows that what happens on Riser stays on Riser. But they can always meet here again some other time. Once more they kiss, and Picard returns to the ship, promptly to begin HR proceedings on Riker having too much of an opinion on Picard's sex life. God damn it.
Oh. Wow.
I still have a bit more, so...
That's all right. I'll start the stopwatch.
Okay. They kiss and Picard returns to the ship to promptly begin HR proceedings on Riker having too much of an opinion on Picard's sex life. Riker merely grins. He knew Picard would have a great time, and no one got to ride Captain Picard's sexy bald head.
16 seconds over. Oh my god.
So you can tell that when I was writing, the moment the phrase wanted to ride Captain Picard's sexy bald head, I'm like, I am using this as much as possible for the rest of the recap.
The crew definitely needed to get rid of Picard for a bit.
It
felt like he'd obviously been a bit much for them. Have you ever been driven out of a workplace by people that reckon you just need some time?
Not about using the words union busting.
Ah, yes.
You see, I usually did it to myself because when I used to work in the UK, I would get 30 lovely paid holiday days off to use as I would. Believe me, I miss that now. And how I would usually, after Christmas, after all the Christmas parties at the Hilton, that would be when I'd plan my holiday to the US to spend a couple of weeks with Rihanna. And I'd always phrase it as, look, you're going to give me this time off because by the end of the Christmas period, I'm sick to fucking death of y'all and you'll all be sick to fucking death of me. So it's for the best that I just not be here for a month.
It's a kind of reverse of Picard in this.
Basically.
Wow. Yeah, I did like that it felt like at one point they'd evidently had like a group chat or something and tried to rope Bev into like, you know, oh, he listens to you. Go along. Say it's for medical reasons that you need to go on holiday.
See, they're actually repeating a gag from a TOS episode where McCoy uses the same excuse on Picard saying, oh, there's a crew member whose performance is slipping. And Kirk goes, well, this guy has to take shore leave right now. What's his name? And it's Spock goes, James Kirk, Captain. And Kirk realizes he's been bamboozled.
Hey.
Whereas in this one, it's just like, Picard sees through Beverly's plan, like from the get-go. And so they have to bring Troy's mum into this.
Yeah. Yeah. That felt like a low blow, but also a necessary one. Yeah, but this felt like good fun, you know. Yeah, by the looks of it, Patrick Stewart apparently wanted more sex and shooting in the show. So yeah, I keep hearing about these sorts of things, like him wanting some dune buggy action in one of the films and all of this kind of thing. It's like, yeah, sadly he was not Bruce Willis, you know.
I kind of love the idea that, you know, despite being one of the most kind of appearing to be one of our most dignified Shakespearean actors, and given that he, at the beginning of the show, he was very much a dignified Shakespearean actor, oh dear God, what am I doing in this space show, that by season three, he's just become a fucking maniac.
Yeah.
And like in a fun, crazy uncle way and not in like a jerkish Shatner way.
Yes, it's been interesting seeing how he's developed and how Patrick Stewart's tastes have kind of lent in some of these things.
Do you also think like he has to watch, like he gets his stand on, in like most of the episodes he's the one standing on the bridge while Frakes gets to snog and shoot all the time and he's just jealous?
Probably, yeah. This time he gets to go down to the planet and, you know, meet for hot. Oh God. Yeah. So he ended up having Patrick Stewart ended up having an affair with the woman that played Vash.
Yeah.
And that led to the end of his first marriage, apparently, which, yeah. I mean, they've got some good fun chemistry there on the show, but yeah, apparently slightly too much.
Oops.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, overall, this was one of those ones which is, you know, nice light bit of fluff of a show. We also get to see Max Grodenchik before his turn as Rom. So that was neat. Although jarring, seeing like Rom's face, but not Rom's voice.
And without any of Rom's cuddliness.
Yes, yeah, this is very much an unpleasant Ferengi. You know, which I guess a lot of them in TNG are specifically that.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a while before you start getting the nicer Ferengi or the more complex Ferengi.
I like the idea of archaeology working backwards. That it's a relic that got built in the future and they promptly hid it in the past.
I hadn't thought of it as backwards archaeology, but yeah.
Yeah. It's like the Bill and Ted approach to temporal dynamics of later on we'll hide the thing and the thing will be here now, but we have to remember to do it or else it doesn't work.
Yeah, it did feel a little convenient that, oh yes, we knew that you would destroy it at this time sort of thing. But yeah, it was an interesting thing going, okay, you've got these hijinks going on and this time travel element, which I guess in Starfleet you just get used to that sort of thing of, oh yeah, yeah, which century in the future are you from? Okay, and the time filth haven't shown up, so I guess this isn't anything big.
And I guess like this, it's got nothing to do with the temporal Cold War of Enterprise, so there we go.
Yeah, yeah, but it's probably fine.
Although, the alien designs, kind of like the Vorgans, I keep wanting to call them Vogons, but just like, they have weird faces, which I swear I've seen in a 60s Outer Limits episode. Like the weird kind of, they have like the mouth gills.
Yeah, it's an odd look.
Mm. Out of all the planets we've encountered so far in Star Trek, where would you go for holiday?
And that's a difficult one, because you've got a lot of planets with like, you know, Macbeth witch ghosts and things like that, you know. Like Riser, at least, you know, I've been that person sat by the pool reading a book, trying not to get, you know, trying to avoid it getting splashed by people jumping into the pool, you know. And there's archaeology in Riser as well.
And has anyone tried to ride your sexy bald head?
Wow.
Final episode. Good night, everybody.
Oh dear. Well, I've not had the weird statue.
The Horgan.
So yeah. Also, it's not entirely bald yet. It's fair, just okay. Mostly bald.
Fair enough. I apologize, yeah. For my
anyway. Yeah. But yeah, Riser seems like a fairly nice, if fairly standard, holiday destination.
It does kind of feel like what I imagined Ibiza would be like in the 90s.
I don't know. Maybe in a primetime TV version of it. Yeah. How about you? Kronos?
No, it's all like, you know, it's usually raining all the time, so I'm good with that. I don't know. Maybe.
Like, Bajor would have the fun archaeology, just the not fun religious side of it as
yeah.
Well.
Like, I wouldn't want to go on a holiday. That seems too dangerous.
Mm.
So, I don't know, maybe like one of those kind of gangster planets? Like one of those cowboy worlds? Or, you know, I'd go to, you know, I know what it'd be. It'd be one of those worlds which has like a Renfair castle. So, I know Rihanna would want to go to like a Renfair planet.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, that one from the first episode with the Klingons in. There you go. There's a nice Renfair planet and weird godlike entities keeping it kind of peaceful.
Now, can I count 24th century Earth?
I mean, maybe. Like, I don't know. I'd be curious to see what 24th century Brighton would be like, given the current way the world has gone, possibly underwater. But yeah. Who knows?
You'd want to see if, like, oh, you want to see if Hugh survives the 24th century, don't you?
Oh, God, he would. Yeah, just out there on the downs. So yeah, this was one of those good TNGs, even if it was a bit fairly light, kind of fluffy thing. So we have a big list, and we're going to need to figure out where we're putting it on there. The list currently stands at 96 entries. We are almost at our 100th item ranked, which we'll be doing next time. But for now, this list has Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, right all the way at number one. It has, around the halfway point, we've got Persistence of Vision in place 49 from Voyager, where a weird space jerk makes the crew hallucinate and hijinks ensue. And then right down at the bottom, we have Strange New Worlds is Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach, where a machine kills kids to let a city fly, and we won't bother doing anything about it. So where on this list does it does this lie?
Let's see. Okay.
And look around the halfway point. We've got a few TNGs. We've got Heart of Glory, where Worf meets some other Klingons. And that's at spot 41. We've got Genesis at almost exactly the half. Yeah, almost exactly the halfway point where Barclay became a spider.
And where Worf definitely killed a guy.
Yeah, Worf definitely did kill a guy.
Okay, I'm looking at Carbon Creek, which is number 43, which is Enterprise.
Yes, good Enterprise episode.
I think Carbon Creek... Well, okay, this is a lot more fun. But I feel Carbon Creek is a really good 45 minutes of TV. And also at the same time, it always, you know, like... It's a good episode of Enterprise, so do we add like an extra point onto that because it's doing the impossible?
I think it's that thing where quite often we look at episodes and go, are they fun? Are they important for Star Trek as a whole? And neither Carbon Creek or Captain's Holiday are important as such, but Carbon Creek's definitely more interesting.
I think that, you know, Captain's Holiday is only important to Patrick Stewart's early 90s male ego.
Yeah.
Because he basically has got to one around in like a skimpy, like luminous G-string, which I've definitely seen in Brighton on Pride weekend, and just wants to go, yes, I am empty up here, but I am Neil Adams 70s Batman everywhere else.
Yes. Yeah. Very hairy everywhere else. Mm. And the ladies on Riser all want a piece of this captain.
Apparently, Roddenberry wanted like to see other types of, like, you know, men, women.
Mm.
But either Berman or TV standards of practice kind of put the kibosh on that, because, you know, Gene Roddenberry was a horny pervy fucker, and we should all just admit that more.
Yeah, it's that thing where a complicated man, but some of his ideas are good ones, and yeah, it would have been good to have seen more like diverse groups and relationships in this, but yeah, it's interesting seeing that that was intended as happening. And of course, nemesis of the pod, Rick Berman, being one of the people that might...
I thought nemesis of the pod was Ed Sheeran.
We can have more than one nemesis.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, good.
Yeah. He's not stopped being that.
But, okay. I would say Carbon Creek... Because, yeah, I just kind of, I do kind of like that fish out of water narrative. Mm. And it's also, you know, Jalim Balok, who plays T'Pol, playing her ancestor, is a nice little performance. And there is some nice little bits.
Yeah. It feels very much like an episode of odd science fiction television that's good. Like, Jolene Blalock didn't feel like she stretched her acting muscles in what we've seen of season one of Enterprise. So actually seeing her get to do some things here was good. So yeah, as far as below that, we've got DS9's Forsaken, another Luoxana Troi episode, where she's turned her attention to Odo, which, again, fairly light, fairly frivolous. I think Captain's Holiday might be better than that.
I would have to admittedly disagree.
Oh.
I do like the interplay between Odo and Luoxana.
That is true.
Because like whenever we have Luoxana turn up with Picard, there is the power dynamic and balance, but it feels like Picard has the ability to go, please, madam, I'm space French British. Whereas Odo's reaction is just kind of, it's always, Odo who is always very like the gruff, no nonsense. It's always nice when you get to see like a reaction from him, which is a different emotion.
Yeah, something more than surly.
Yeah, and I always think that brings out the lovely little facets of the character that he himself usually buries because he wants to present, you know, that he is just and fair, but he has no clue how women work. And Luxana clearly wants to take a swim in Odo.
Yes. Yeah. I think that does make a good point. Like, we see some lovely vulnerability from both of them, even with some wacky hijinks going on.
And also, I think, isn't that the one where Bashir manhandles a bunch of ambassadors and diplomats to save them?
Yeah, that was good fun.
Yeah. So, then it's the ultimate question. It does go back to Genesis. Do we prefer our Captain Picard to running around being a lemur, or do we want him to run around punching people and generally being naked most of the time?
I mean, it's difficult, but I think for me, the lemur has it.
All right, okay then.
You know, I like Genesis. It's taken a lot of lumps to end up in spot 45 on our list. But I think this time it's Genesis' day.
Yep, Genesis has triumphed. All right, so we'll put this at the... Oh, no, that's not fair.
You've seen what's next.
Yeah, and you know me. This is The Stars at Night, which is the season 3 conclusion of Lower Decks. And like the same way I have a soft spot for Odo, I love Shax. And anytime Shax clearly has the best day is always like top Star Trek for me.
When it's a nice culmination of so much that went on during season 3.
Yeah. And Shaq's finally getting to eject the warp core.
A lifelong dream.
And everyone's enthusiastic cheering of Shaq's getting to eject the warp core.
Well, yeah, they know.
They know.
Okay, so that would push this down to spot 47. I think this is probably better than Data Lore that's currently in its place.
Yeah.
You know, less relevant, but still very good fun.
Yep.
Cool. So, take that, Law.
Something I say all the time on Twitter.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Again, just cut Twitter out. It's been so nice being on the other side of that.
I need to. Okay, so, what is our next episode?
So, our second episode of the evening is Star Trek Lower Decks Season 3, Episode 5, titled Reflections. This aired on the 22nd of September 2022, written by Mike McMahon, directed by Michael Mullen. The UK number one was Peter Capaldi's greatest shame, Lewis Capaldi, with Forget Me, If Only. And the US was Harry Styles with As It Was, which I'm sure has appeared on our list a couple of times already. I'd only heard the one Lewis Capaldi song, and I did not care for it. And now I wish I'd heard only the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was not good.
No.
It was an interesting juxtaposition of a kind of summary video with yet more miserable whining from him.
What, was there at least any Peter Capaldi in the video?
No.
Shame.
Yep. Yeah, and Harry Styles, it's alright. Feels very referential to other tracks, but, you know, not bad. So, yes.
Yeah. Okay, are you ready to talk about Reflection?
Yes.
Okay, engage.
Cool. So Rutherford's been having some weird nightmares that end with an explosion. For the rest of the crew, though, they're at Tolgana 4 again. There's very little to do at the moment, so it's time to fill in some Starfleet quotas. For Mariner and Boimler, that means running a Starfleet recruitment booth. And Ransom's annoyed with Mariner trying to shirk duties and says if either of them set foot out of the booth, it'll be off to Starbase 80 with them. And that's one of the bad Starbases. Tendi helps Rutherford with his bad dreams by clearing his memory cache, as it's probably just embarrassing memories he's got rattling around there, right? It all seems fine until he wakes up from a nap with his cybernetic eye gone all red. He starts wandering around the ship, criticizing everything until he sees the real Rutherford in his reflection. And these two really fucking hate each other. Over at the stall, it looks like there might be some interest in Starfleet from a Tellarite. But a woman from the Independent Archaeologist Guild keeps putting people off, telling them that they'll just be stuck indoors all the time or they'll get turned into a Borg drone. You know, the usual kind of stuff. The bad Rutherford is acting like a jerk in the real world while his reflection is unable to do anything about it, especially when he sees Ensign Barnes, who the real Rutherford's got a thing for. The real Rutherford accidentally lets slip about Tendi's existence, and bad Rutherford manages to use her to find out about the ship's security patterns. The Rutherford's fight with reflection version able to futz with the physical Rutherford's cybernetics. And the fight confuses Tendi, who calls for a medical team after Rutherford shoves her over and runs away, something he would never normally do. The archaeologist down at the stall apparently has a bone to pick with Starfleet, as she worked for them for a while. She introduces herself as Petra Aberdeen, and she's got an impressive Starfleet record, having worked on better ships than the Cerritos. The bad Rutherford tries to beam away, and Shax explains that Baby Bear would know that's not possible where they're at in space. He tries to steal the captain's yacht, and the reflection version of Rutherford helps distract him until Shax can arrive, overpower him, and Tana scans him to go, this isn't an evil Rutherford, it's an earlier, much more jerk-like Rutherford. The pair are going to be trapped in his brain, duking it out to see who's in charge. Speaking of which, they are both in a weird white void until one of them can leave. The young Rutherford has more of a mastery of this place, having been trapped here for a while, and decides it's him, and tries to run away, but Rutherford stops him, and they need to figure their drama out. Oh, no. They'll be trapped in there forever now.
Yeah, all right. Okay, time to recap, or else you'll be trapped in the white void.
Oh, no, not again.
All right, and go.
So, apparently, the young Rutherford was an illegal ship racer until an explosion caused him to get cybernetics and have a memory wipe, which was allegedly elective. So he's got no idea of this illegal ship racing. Instead, they're going to have a space race to see who's more deserving of survival. At the stall, the archaeology stands poaching people who were curious about Starfleet with the promise of doing things like touching mummies, which frankly, we've seen that kind of thing happen in Starfleet as well, but whatever. The Collectors Guild makes fun of Boimler and Mariner, and some truthers start asking, where did Sisko really go? And what's up with those conspiracy bugs that we've not covered yet in the podcast? Valid points, kind of, but let's not encourage these people. The Rutherfords build their ships, and as is tradition for Lower Decks, our Rutherfords is a reference to previous Star Trek lore with the Delta Flyer. Some Ferengi are now making fun of Boimler and Rutherford, Boimler and Mariner now. And after Boimler's pip is removed by some Starbase loser, Boimler rages out. He attacks everyone, saying they don't want to fight Klingons or do conspiracies or whatever. They want to explore and do science. He even shouts at some Wadi about putting people in games.
Okay, wait, hang on. I'm pausing this because you know what we got to do now.
Okay.
Because they're here, so you know we have to do it. It's tradition.
Okay.
On the count of three. One, two, three. Alan Moraine!
Alan Moraine!
Alan Moraine, move along home!
Yes! So, anyway, that rage actually impresses some of the passers-by who are like, wow, that guy's really confident in Starfleet. Over in Dream Space, it's time for a space race. And if you've ever played the board game Galaxy Trucker, it's basically that. Rutherford has made the one thing that the younger Rutherford never had, friends. His crew of dream constructs of his friends help him out, especially when a warbird shows up and blasts young Rutherford's ship. The dream Tendi beams him out to safety, but is already too badly injured. Back in reality, Ransom shows up at the stall, sees Mariner dealing with a busy crowd, and also Boimler is still raging. Well done, Mariner, and it's off to the brig for a night for Boimler, even if Ransom kind of respects his behaviour. Young Rutherford is dying, meaning R. Rutherford will be the dominant one. He gives R. Rutherford a memory of the explosion that blew him up, and the shadowy figures who rebuilt him, removing his memories and saying they'll pretend like it was elective to scrub his memory. Ooh, dear. Ooh. We close with Mariner on log duty, and she gets interrupted by Petra Aberdeen, who explains she doesn't really hate Starfleet that much. She was just using them as a distraction to steal Grand Nagus's fancy staff from the Ferengi. There's definitely some vibes going on with Mariner and Petra, and Mariner decides to save her contact details for later.
3 minutes and 18 seconds.
Wow. Okay. That was a bit long than I intended.
Yeah. All I've got to say about young Rutherford.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is pod racing.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting seeing young Rutherford. I'd completely forgotten about that angle and picked this episode because, again, it's got kind of some archaeology vibes, just as it turns out, very much in a B-plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, but for Rutherford's story was very good fun. Seeing the young arsehole version of him in charge and trying to outthink the ship or the people on it. Well done, Shax, for sussing out what had gone on there. And I like that it was a younger Rutherford rather than a specifically evil Rutherford.
Yeah.
He just, you know.
He's young and he's a jerk. He's tech bro of Rutherford.
Oh god. Oh, he would be as well. That version of him. That was an entertaining storyline. Managed to see an interesting side of one of the characters, which will end up going on till the stars at night.
Did you notice that when he's looking through people on the pad at the end, and he's talking about, you know, who could have been behind his implant, the first one we see is the Admiral who gets revealed to be the bad Admiral who's behind the plot.
I did not clock that. That's amazing. Good work, McMahon. You know, that's nice. The recruitment stall stuff, I really enjoyed. It was very silly.
I think the bit where Boimler just loses his shit is possibly, in terms of Lower Deck clips I've played, my wife and I have watched again and again on YouTube, this might be the most popular one AM after Moopsie.
Wow. That's saying a lot.
And just Have you ever raged that much about your job? In defense of your job.
In defense of it? Probably. Yeah, I was thinking I've raged a bit like that about Man of Steel before. But
You didn't ever go to Fantastic Store and say, fuck you, Dave's is better.
No, I was generally on fairly amicable terms with the competitors. Yeah, it didn't stop some things going on rivalry-wise, but overall with that work, it was generally pretty positive. It was more, I guess, the bank work that I did, where things could get a bit animated sometimes.
I think on the whole, I was generally on good terms with other Starbucks. Mm. Especially since, you know, in a crisis, you do have to, and if you need like more stock or things like cups and lids, which you run out of a lot, you had to be on good terms with other stores to be able to have to keep the scrounge network going.
Of course. I mean, I'm guessing there wasn't an equivalent of like Costa or Nero that you'd have as your rivals.
No, because I think our closest rivals would actually be like franchised Starbucks in like either Target or Barnes and Noble. And it usually comes down less to rivalry and more, we don't serve those pastries or your Barnes & Noble card won't work here.
Ah, so less fun.
Yeah, I have actually somehow managed to make another Starbucks think that their store is cursed.
Good.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned this story on the podcast.
I think so. Possibly.
Possibly. Because there's one store which was built on top of a demolished Denny's. And they had a very long run of bad luck. And I would just jokingly say that's because that store is cursed. Because like in Poltergeist, you know, it's built on cursed ground and they didn't move the bodies. And somehow, through that and other members of staff, this disseminated down. So now there is a store that believes that its store is actually cursed. Good job, me.
Well done. As far as the archaeology side of it, there's not as much in here as I thought, but Petra Aberdeen and the Independent Archaeologists Guild is going to come back a few times.
The Indie Archaeologists Guild.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah.
I did like, I like the conspiracy guys, and I like the, the Starbase people who are just, who are comparing, like, their fashions. It's like, hey, I've got this belt. Can you wear a belt?
Oh, dear. Yes, having a go at Starfleet for changing their uniforms so often.
Mm. But the flap is pretty cool, though.
The flap's good, yeah, yeah. That's the thing. We've seen the live-action version of this uniform that the Cerritos staff wear, and it's a good uniform.
Yeah.
You know, it works nicely.
I feel that in the DS9 kind of era uniforms, that there's stuff you can do with them which gives you kind of more character than you have with, like, the basic one-piece jumpsuits.
Hmm.
Because it seems like you can take like the jacket part off. Or I always like how O'Brien has like the sleeves on his perpetually rolled up.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a similar thing with Mariner.
With Mariner.
With these, where, yeah, it's keeping a uniform but doing something that's specifically characterful about it.
But the important question, the super important question.
Hmm.
What is on Starbase 80 that's so bad? Oh, and also, where this goes in the big list.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. And is Starbase 80 the one that Mariner ends up being sent to?
I think it is.
Because, yeah, that seemed like a shit place to be.
But there's always that the thing of you don't explain the joke.
No.
Like, when you say a place is really bad, you kind of have to not show it. Or just like the sitcom Nemesis, who you hear about but never actually see until the very end. And you're like, oh yeah, mm-hmm. they're a nice guy. It's just that this one character really hates them.
Yeah.
It's like you're constantly referring to the blasted Heath. I'm sure if I went there, it would be quite a nice Heath.
I don't know. It's a strange place. So, yeah, Lower Decks-wise... Our highest Lower Decks is still where Pleasant Fountains lie, with the LARP ship and the evil Jeffrey Combs bot, which I feel does put it generally above a lot of other ones.
Sorry, where Pleasant Fountains lie is better.
Yeah.
Like, this is fun, and I do love the Boimler outburst at the very end, but it doesn't have a Jeffrey Combs bot, and it doesn't have Boimler outsmarting the Jeffrey Combs bot.
Yes. Yeah, it's that thing of there are bits in this. Like, for Rutherford's story's fun, but it's not the best Lower Decks story. The stall stuff is good fun, but
it definitely feels like we took two plots going on, we're just going to smush them together, and it's not going to be like a strongly put together episode, but it's going to be fun.
Yeah. With that in mind, would you put this as better than The Stars at Night or worse? Because again, Stars at Night has that fun culmination of everything coming together. You've got both the Rutherford story and Shax always wanting to eject the warp core.
Stars at Night... Also, Stars at Night has like your big damn heroes moment when all the Cali class turn up to save the day. You got some good Star Trek themes like man versus technology.
Yeah, well, and yeah, the especially relevant these days, the kind of automation of jobs and all of that, which feels worryingly relevant even now. Okay, I'd say even possibly below IE Excretus, which similarly has quite a reference heavy side to it with all of the different holodeck scenarios, but those are very good fun scenarios.
Man, it feels like Lower Decks is generally a good show, but it's kind of been lumped in like the midway point of our list.
It really has, hasn't it? Because yeah, the lowest we've got is 59 with Second Contact, and the highest we've got is 42 with Where Pleasant Fountains Lie. And yeah, and yet still I'm looking more around this kind of area.
Yeah, and then you got okay, so below I Excretus at 51 you have The Least Dangerous Game, where we do kind of see the start of the kind of more assertive Boimler storyline, which you kind of had through season 3. The bold Boimler plotline, even though Mariner just keeps saying, stop trying to make that a thing. It's not a thing.
And yet, it kind of becomes a thing. Yeah, you've also got the wellness planet with the weird kind of checks and balances.
It's a series of checks and balances.
I don't know. I might put this above Least Dangerous Game.
All right.
Which, you know, is fun, but not...
Even though that one has Martok Klingon D&D.
Yeah. Yeah, just because I don't know. I'm fairly particular with role-playing games being presented in things. And it was fine, but yeah, I don't know.
Be honest. You want them to be playing GURPS.
Oh god, no, I want no one to be playing GURPS. I've played GURPS. God, I played GURPS based on the 2000 AD strip Leviathan.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that was good fun.
Okay, so quick side question. Which is the better system? GURPS or Rifts?
Now, I've only played GURPS... I've played GURPS for 3 sessions and Rifts for 1. I like the ludicrousness of Rifts. GURPS was more entertaining to make something in, even if it was very much a spreadsheet nerd's idea of joy. Neither I cared for, though.
Fair enough. Okay, at least,
yes.
At least I didn't ask you Champions.
Champions I had a character creator on a floppy disk and made hundreds of characters for, but it never appealed as anything to actually run or play.
All right, so...
So, anyway, that would what put this at the new 51?
Yeah. You know, I am going to say number 50 because the Voyage episode Persistence of Vision...
Yeah.
...wasn't great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those ones where a lot of them we... on our list, and we do share a public version of the list on the Nerd and Tie forums, we have brief descriptions of what they're about. And Persistence of Vision is one that I almost always have to look at and go, what was this? Yeah, it was the, that was the cucumber sandwiches one, wasn't it?
Cucumber sandwiches, I believe so, yes.
Yeah, which could have been more sinister. Hopefully we'll get some more sinister things, especially for this year's Halloween. Okay, so that is our second episode ranked, and we're now up to 98. So, 99th ranked thing on the list. So yes, our third episode is Star Trek Enterprise Season 2, Episode 3, titled Minefield. This aired on the 2nd of October 2002, written by John Shaban, directed by James Contner. The UK and US number one hits. The UK had Pink with Just Like a Pill, and the US had Nelly with Dilemma. And both of these, like, this is still heavily in my comic shop working days. So both of these I heard way too much on Radio 1 back in the day. Although Nelly, I think, outlasted Just Like a Pill.
See, I'm sure I know these songs via like osmosis, and they're probably playing in like the student union bar when I was at uni. But that was pretty much it. I wasn't really listening to music, and I wasn't listening to music on the radio regularly. That wouldn't be until like I get a job working in factories and hotels when the radio is playing. True story.
Okay. Yeah, for me, I guess, I don't know, I didn't hang out in student union bar kind of places enough. Most of my fellow library students were mature students with day jobs. And I had a job as well, working at the comic shop. So it was there that we had the radio on, mainly when my manager and I disagreed about what would make good shop music. As he didn't approve of Tom Waits there, and I didn't approve of Bob Dylan.
Wait. This is Steve, right?
Yeah. As shop music.
Depends. Which Tom Waits?
I did have like Frank's Wild Years and, you know, some of the livelier stuff.
Okay,
you know?
So like as a Tom Waits fan, like Swordfish Trombone, one of my favorite albums, not good shop music.
No.
Closing Time, that's great shop music. Orphans, Brawlers, Ballers, Brawlers, and Bastards. Great comment. Great shop music. And which Dylan was he going with?
It was. Is it Blonde on Blonde?
No. It's you got to do. It's Highway.
Repeatedly. Like that was my Saturday for many a day in the shop. So for radio was a neutral ground.
I like Blonde on Blonde. Hmm. That's not good comic shop album music.
Nope. Yeah, so that's where we ended up with things like Just Like a Pill and Dilemma.
That's what Dylan and the Dead is for.
Ah. Oh, well. So, Mars, I believe for once, it's your turn to do an Enterprise.
I think I've recapped Enterprise more than you. I think I'm banking all my Enterprises to be able to twist the knife and make you have to recap a truly dire Enterprise episode. Hang on, let's
go. Enterprise at its most war on terror.
Let's have a look. Come on, I swear, Enterprise. Okay. Do we not? No? Okay.
Why am I scrolling that far up looking for Enterprise episodes?
Hang on, Enterprise. Let's have a look. The show then descends into petty squabbling as Miles and Charlie argue over who's done Enterprise, who's recapped Enterprise more. Let's see.
It's all right. We'll be doing this with Picard as well soon enough.
One for Charlie. One for Miles. One for Charlie. Wow, I'm scrolling down. That's okay. So far, Charlie has 3. Miles. Charlie 4. Oh man, then I have I think we actually come out as equal, but one of my episodes of Enterprise is Broken Bow. So that's length. So that might, I think that might put me ahead.
Wow. And given the track record, you do have the worst Enterprise episodes as well.
So it seems to be like you have the good Enterprise episodes, like the ones which are actually like high up on the list. And by high up, I mean the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go right down to the 90s, and I basically have a hat trick of Enterprise episodes.
Mm. Lovely.
All right. Okay. So I'll slap one extra onto my side of the equation. So when it comes to the Trip is Pregnant episode, or the one where Dr. Phlox does a genocide.
Great. Yep. The Hank McCoy move. Okay. Good. So before then, it's minefield time. So let's go.
Malcolm Reed has breakfast with Captain Archer, and he couldn't be more British about the whole bloody thing. Archer wants to get to know Reed, and Reed just wants to have a third member of staff on the security detail. But thankfully, Reed's living hell is interrupted by the Enterprise discovering an M-class planet that Archer wants to explore. As they get closer, something explodes and severely damages the ship. Turns out this planet is surrounded by a minefield. Each mine is completely cloaked so they can't see the mine. Oh, wait, except for that one. Right there. That's latched itself onto the hull with big spikes. Reed dons a spacesuit and heads out into space to defuse the bomb. Tucker, meanwhile, is working on depolarizing that particular hull plate so that if Reed can't defuse it, they can just jettison the hull plate into space. An alien ship decloaks, but Hoshi was wounded in the explosion, so she's in sickbay, and she's unable to decipher the alien language. The aliens fire some warning shots, and Meriwether does some fancy flying to avoid them. Careful, Travis! We've got a guy out there trying to defuse a mine. The mine gets a little jostled, thwarting Reed's plan as the mine shoots out more spikes to attach itself more firmly to the hull. Oh! Reed's leg got in the way. So now, not only is he pinned to the hull of the ship, he's got a scar. He's got a scar for that one. Bloody typical. Archer gets into a spacesuit and goes up to help Reed. Hoshi deciphers the language, and these guys are from some place called the Remulan Star Empire. Wait, sorry, that's the Romulan Star Empire. I think we've heard these guys before. Their communications have been deciphered as a warning to leave. But they can't do that with the mine attached, and Archer just won't jettison the hull plate and let a guy die. Not on his watch. As he and Reed work on the mine, they finally get to have their little chat. Reed's family used to be Royal Navy. Depressing fact, this means that the Royal Family survives till the 22nd century. In fact, Reed's uncle once sacrificed himself to save the crew on a submarine he was stationed on. Reed joins Starfleet because he's aquaphobic and scared of drowning. Reed admits that he thinks Archer's command style is far too lax and a bit too social, and Archer counters that due to the nature of Enterprise being so far away from any other humans, the crew had to become much more tight-knit and depend on each other. As they talk, it becomes very clear that Reed is prepared to sacrifice himself to save the Enterprise and to save Archer. As they think they've defused the mine rearms itself, and the Romulans are getting pretty insistent on the whole "you need to leave or we're gonna kill you" demands. Looks like Reed's gonna get his death wish fulfilled. Archer's still insistent he can save Reed, so Reed forces the issue by disconnecting his oxygen and trying to suffocate himself. Archer gives him a quick boost of his own oxygen, but realizes, wait, when we rearm the mine, there was a delay, about 20 seconds. Reed thinks it's 10, but Archer's got a plan now. Looks like Reed's going to get to disconnect that deck plate after all, but not before he gives Archer two shuttle pod door hatches and a plasma torch. They jettison the deck plate, and Archer cuts through the spike, pinning Reed with the plasma torch. Pulling Reed free, the two use the shuttle pod hatches to protect themselves from the explosion and are picked up by the Enterprise just as the Romulans are preparing to attack. Guys, you're a little too eager right now. Can you give us a second? Chill. The Enterprise warps away to safety. Reed still thinks it was 10 seconds, while Archer tells him that it was 20. Captain's orders. And the Enterprise limps away, hopefully not finding any repair stations, which might be dangerously psychotic and murderous. And to see our opinion on that story, please go back to episode 31 of our show. It's very funny, and we also talk about salt vampires. To play us out, and a dedication to Reed being a little bit of a smeghead, it's cold outside, there's no kind of atmosphere, I'm all alone, more or less. Let me fly far away from here, fun, 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 in the sun, sun, sun. I want to lie shipwrecked, a comatose, drinking fresh mango juice, goldfish shells nibbling at my toes. Fun, fun, fun in the sun, sun, sun. Fun, fun, fun in the sun, sun, sun. Dun, 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 dun.
Wow, and that is 5 minutes.
Oh yes.
Yeah, I watched this, and my first thought about on seeing how utterly awkward Reed was speaking to the captain in private, and that he basically just wanted to bring his work stuff. I was like, yeah, he's not going to get gazpacho soup, is he? He was channeling such Arnold Rimmer.
That is, as a Brit who spends a lot of time around very, very eager Americans, that is sometimes how my life feels.
Wow.
Wait, hang on. So wait, I actually managed to get the entire episode in 5 minutes.
You did?
Including like the 60, about the minutes or so it took me to sing the song.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Damn. Damn.
I was wondering if you were timing that.
No. Because,
yeah, no. I was watching it count down going, yeah, you've still got like half a minute. This is fine. Oh, my.
Go, yeah. Go me. Go me is what I'm saying.
So, yeah, this is one of those interesting points now of being, you know, now 99 things recapped, where this bridges Carbon Creek, which happened just before this, and the spooky rest stop episode that came just afterwards, where the ship had been battered pretty brutally by a bunch of mines. So this one was picked primarily because it's got weird, shady Romulan technology. And the problem is, there is weird, shady Romulan technology that is confirmed to be in Discovery Season 5. But it's from an episode we covered already, because it's the weird phasing thing that allow a cloaking device that allows you to phase through solid matter.
Okay.
Yeah, that's going to be that one from TNG is going to be in Discovery somehow, apparently. I was like, well, let's do some shady Romulan technology. And this has the curious thing of being about Romulans in an era where no one sees Romulans.
Yeah.
You know, it's all drones, it's all virtual kind of things, because we've got to wait until Balance of Terror before people go, oh my god, they look exactly like Vulcans, that's weird. I do like some good shady Romulan hijinks though, and this kind of minefield and the horrid bureaucracy of that kind of, yeah, no, you're getting out of here, like, we get it, you stumbled on here by mistake, fuck off though. That guy that's pinned to there, you know, we've heard your plans. You want to jettison part of that? Brilliant. Love that plan. That guy on it, fuck him. You've got several more.
Fuck him. He's British.
I mean, Romulans probably don't know specifically that. Just, that guy looks incredibly awkward. You're probably doing him a favour at this point.
Look, he's trying to kill himself at this point. It might be better to just do this.
God, Reed is so eager to die valiantly and selflessly for this whole thing.
What a smeghead.
Yeah.
That said, I did actually enjoy this episode.
Yeah, it was good fun.
I feel like Star Trek, until much later, you know, we don't get many episodes where we just have like, wait, actually no, you do get kind of bottle episode because most of it is really just Archer and Reed on the side of the ship just talking about themselves.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is the first, you know, even though we've watched, like, how many episodes of this show?
What, 8 if we're including the pilot as 2?
Yeah. I feel like this is the like one of the few times where we get to see Archer being more than just square-jawed space hero.
Yeah.
And I think that's the, you know, because Scott Bakula can do charming. He can do, like, charming, oh shucks, all-American in a way that is not the swagger of James, of any of the James Cooks. Like, he just has that good old Democrat, liberal Democrat kind of charm.
It's that thing of it's nice seeing him in that position, which I gather the showrunners were also in that thing of we can't do red shirts in this. We can't kill people wantonly because they are out on their own and there aren't many people in the crew. So when people die, it's got to be a big thing.
Yeah, I liked how they do kind of make a factor, you know, 17 people get wounded. And it looks like with Phlox that there is triage going on.
Yeah.
And it's nice that, like, you know, you get, you know, and it's, you know, from an explosion, it's not like, oh no, he's been turned to soup. But yeah, like, the, you know, it they do, the ship feels constrained. The ship feels tight, and I liked the part where Reed's like, you don't act like a captain, you don't act like a military guy. You know, you're just far too casual, you let kind of people say what they want. And Archer's just like, yeah, we're like a hundred people on this ship, so far away from home, we're all alone out here.
Yeah. Well, which again gives that Red Dwarfish feeling. They're on a small confined ship in the middle of nowhere. They've got, you know, again, 2 people just on the outside of the ship having a chat makes for a lot of the drama here, which isn't a million miles away from that.
I do like when Reed gets to kind of be dryly British.
Mm.
Because again, British people just don't seem to exist in Star Trek unless they're French.
Yeah, although Reed feels very British.
Reed feels too British. He feels so British, even I'm going, stop it.
Although we find out he doesn't follow the World Cup, and apparently the World Cup exists. In, at least this far in the future as well.
Well, that's good. Hopefully Accrington Stanley have come back.
I mean, it'd be interesting seeing what sci-fi levels of violence can go on during those matches.
It's hoverball. It's like in Harlem Heroes in 2000 AD, which you started reading today.
Yes, literally today. Yeah, you get people that are now brains in tanks after horrendous accidents.
I like when Star Trek kind of goes small scale.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I don't think we really see that a lot. Because we generally have either a big sci-fi event or big, you know, big kind of space opera shenanigan. Like, you've got the Andorian incident, which is essentially a hostage situation action movie in a temple. But you have the much wider political galactic ramifications of Andorians and the Vulcans, and also Jeffrey Combs.
Of course.
Whereas you just don't... I feel like you don't get just 2 guys, one of whom is quite literally pinned to the ship, one of whom is trying to solve the problem, and the other one's just like, you know, you could just leave me to die. It's fine.
Yeah. I feel awkward about it, but don't worry, I'll be dead.
I'm British, I'm awkward about everything. I was awkward about having eggs earlier. I did like the line when Archer asks him, do you like any sports? And Reed's like, not since you asked me at breakfast, no. I haven't had time.
Oh dear. Well, I mean, Archer can't keep track of everyone's interests, I guess.
No. I like how this actually kind of gave... Everyone kind of had a bit to do. Like, you had Meriwether get to do some fancy minefield flying. which, having played enough minefield levels of Wing Commander, is always an impressive feat in and of itself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, seeing him and Hoshi and Reed all expressing personality traits and doing things, because outside of the core trio and occasionally Phlox, it's felt like they're very much supporting characters.
Yeah. And I enjoyed, like, I enjoyed this one. At no point... I like the spacesuits.
Yeah.
Like, I know it seems like a really weird thing to say, but you very rarely kind of get spacesuits in Star Trek, because, like, budget-wise, it's going to be like, we're not beaming into a vacuum. And when we do it in the animated series, we're going to have big, chunky, ready-breck force field-making belts.
Hmm. Yeah, it's... I think, given this is probably, what, the last Star Trek where you get physical props, you get that sense of physicality, there's something almost a little more precious about it.
Mm.
Of having, you know, in the 60s, it's all obviously made of cardboard and tape and such. And that's, you know, that's charming and that's nice. And with the Enterprise D and with DS9, you've got, and Voyager, you've got a certain aesthetic,
yeah,
which is all very nice, but it is kind of very well carpeted office kind of thing. And then with this, it is a clunky wreck that's mostly... You know, it's props on a soundstage, but it looks lovely in a physical way.
This is the kind of stuff I wish, from what I've seen of Enterprise, that Enterprise did more of.
Yeah.
To kind of play up the not too far removed from our own technology, where it feels real, and this is like 100 years removed from our own level of technology, and not just, ooh, this is basically... little flashy buttons on a computer screen which react to your fingers.
Yeah, so, Miles, where on our big list does this go? Our highest Enterprise episode is 37 with North Star, and it doesn't feel like it gets past that.
No.
In my opinion. Probably same with Carbon Creek.
Yeah, I like this one. This one's a strong episode. Which,
yeah,
for Enterprise, is saying something.
Definitely.
This is the kind of stuff that I'm... this is what makes me glad for the insane task we have given ourselves. Because I believe one of the mission statements we said early on was, neither of us has seen enough Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
We want to see if we can find episodes of Enterprise that we like.
Yes. Yeah, and it's a nice little nugget of treasure when you see that kind of thing. You know, even though looking at the list where I am at the moment, it's like, well, that's still slightly over halfway down. But, you know, this is a fairly positive list.
Yeah.
So it won't, even though it will be a good episode of Enterprise, the number may sound bad at first. Because, yeah, I'm looking at Andorian Incident, which, again, was a very... Star Trek thing, and it was very good fun, especially, you know, you get a bit of Jeffrey Combs in
there. And also, we have how many of episodes of Star Trek do we have? Or let's have a look at progress. Like, we have seen, we need to update this.
Yeah.
Because we have, like, out of 857 plus episodes of Star Trek, we're coming up on 100.
Yeah.
So we have seen one eighth of Star Trek, nearly. Which, you know what? That's impressive.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's going to, you know, the list is going to take time to shape and form. Child Death Machine is going to be at the bottom for a long while to come.
I mean, you never know. You never know what's going to.
unless Strange New Worlds Season 3 does a sequel.
I mean... Who knows if they did a sequel where it's like, right, we've goofed, let's go back there and sort them out, you know?
So, yeah, like, I feel the majority of Enterprise episodes we've seen, which has not been many, but I feel right now, like, we have now seen 9 episodes of Enterprise. And I feel for the most part they've been competent with a few good spots. A few points of make it, oh yes, there is still gas in the Star Trek tank.
Yeah.
You know, Battlestar Galactica hasn't completely taken away our momentum of the sci-fi TV zeitgeist. Although actually Battlestar won't be for another few years.
Yes. Yeah, it's not quite there yet.
No.
Yeah, so, give Ron more time to cook.
Yep. No, that's how we got Helix.
I never told you to watch Helix.
I fell asleep during the first episode of Helix. So I might either try it again or I might just go crazy and go for Outlander.
Yeah, fair enough. Let's see. I think I prefer Andorian Incident, even though it is still our core trio over anyone else.
Yeah, but that one also, it's got Combs.
It's got Combs, yeah. Yeah, I have realised we've probably got enough different shows with him in now to do a second Jeffrey Combs hour.
I am down for another Jeffrey Combs power hour.
Nice.
I think a lot of the later Combs episodes in Enterprise do lean into a lot of the building the Federation stuff of season 4.
Mm. Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Alright, so I'm looking down. I am, man,
Yeah, we've got quite a gulf between the Andorian incident and then, yeah, in the mid-80s for...
Oh, no, it's Home.
The other Enterprises, yep.
All right, okay. Okay, I'm looking at Kobayashi, episode 7, number 70 on the big list.
Oh, yes. See, as much as I like this, I think Kobayashi's a bit more fun.
Yeah.
But at the same time, seeing just under it with Coda. I think Coda doesn't quite land.
No.
Really.
So,
possibly between them as the new 71.
I will go with that.
Nice. Well, we have now ranked 99 whole things on our list. My word. It's good we're planning on doing something extra special for the next one.
Mm.
Yeah. Yes, something which I'm sure will be wonderful for all to experience as we watch Threshold. Yes, it's time for lizard babies and what is often seen as one of the worst episodes of Star Trek. Is this true? We saw Tuvix and we loved that, so who knows?
See, the horrifying thing is, if this is how we set ourselves up as a precedence, Is episode start of Star Trek 200 that we cover going to be that one with the next gen episode with the Oirish settlers?
I was thinking Code of Honor.
Oh God! not the episode where Quark has a sex change.
I mean, there is that. That has been threatened a bit. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. Worryingly, I do think we could probably get a whole 3-episode chunk of episodes where Star Trek does agenda pretty badly.
Oh God.
Yeah.
I feel like we need to get Celeste on speed dial for that one.
Yeah, probably. So yeah. But next time, Threshold. And for us, we have several places where you can reach us both as the show and individually. As the show, you can find us on Blue Sky as casualtrek.bsky.social. You can find us on the Nerd and Tie forums, and also you can find us on Ko-fi, where we've got a small backlog, but we will be doing donor specific episodes. So if you want to throw us literally any money, we're not fussy. Suggest an episode or a character or a theme, and we will build you an episode for podcast based around that. Miles, aside from that, where can you be found?
You can find me on Blue Sky at marsreedlabato.bsky.social. And you can find my blog at mareedlabato.wordpress.com. And Charlie, where can the nice folks find you?
So, I can be found also on Blue Sky at skyshark.bsky.social. And over at Faked Tales, where I blog about stuff sometimes, I really need to use this as a reminder to shame myself into actually blogging about stuff.
Shame, shame.
Thank you. Hopefully I've got something appearing on Who Dares Rolls fairly soon.
Ooh.
Where I talk about board games and role-playing games.
What? Board games and role-playing games? This is something you've never exhibited any interest in this show whatsoever.
In this episode, no.
In this episode, no. At no point have we mentioned a generic universal role-playing system.
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. And on that note, that's it from us. So, yeah, go to a Starfleet. This should be airing roughly around the time that Discovery Season 5 starts. So how right or wrong were we? Probably pretty wrong. So, yeah, enjoy that. Mock us online for how wrong we were.
Don't forget to rate and view us on all good podcast catchers and apps.
Yes, we have only had a couple of reviews so far. If we get any suitably favourable or entertaining ones, we'll probably read them out here.
Yeah. And with that, live long, have a jelly baby, and don't forget to practice safe Horgar. Horgan. Safe Horgan.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Labato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount.
So,
not us.
What's next?
Not yet. Know.